Pierna derecha, directo al arco. ¡Golazo! ¡Golazo!
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Monday, September 24th, 2018. Joining us on the line today to talk about the NWSL final and the great week for the Philadelphia Union, Jonathan Tannenwald of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm not sure I know quite what time it is, but I'm here.
How was the game? Did you enjoy your experience out there?
Portland is a wonderful city and above all a wonderful soccer city. I have said before, I think it's the very best in the United States, and it showed off this weekend. Some beautiful weather and a really, really good soccer game, obviously played in front of a packed house at Providence Park, and the coronation of what I think we can fairly say is the greatest women's soccer team in the professional era for clubs here in the United States.
Fair enough. Yeah, I was going to go that direction in terms of history. And your article, certainly, that you wrote from the game, makes it pretty clear that you feel that this team, both in terms of accomplishment and sort of aesthetics, is right up there in the top. It comes from a small market. It came from a small market in particular, and it built this program, this team concept. How did they build it in your mind, though? How has this North Carolina program become so successful?
Well, I'm gonna counter the small market point a little bit, if I may, because within the NWSL context, they are not a small market. They are of the same organization as North Carolina FC in the USL, and by virtue of being a club, you know, with a men's and a women's team, that makes them one of the larger organizations in the NWSL. No, they're not an MLS. You know, not under an MLS team's umbrella, but still, you know, they have the full training resources and all of the things off the field that you would want to have that the men have access to. And I think that matters a lot in terms of how your day-to-day work affects what you do on Saturday and Sunday, you know? To the point of how they built this team, they've been building it now for a few years. It started with the West, when this organization, the Courage, or when I should say this team, not this organization, when they were the Western New York Flash, and they won the NWSL championship in the teams last year in New York with a number of these same players, Jessica McDonald, Lynn Williams, a few others. And then when the NWSL judged that it was time for the Salins to give the team up because they could not keep the pace with the requirements for infrastructure and investment that were rightly being applied as the league grew. The owners of North Carolina FC came in, and they were the Railhawks, I guess, at that point, weren't they? Came in and bought the franchise, and they moved to the same suburbs of Raleigh, North Carolina, where the Railhawks, now known as North Carolina FC, play. They brought with them a number of good players. They also brought with them a really good coach in Paul Riley, who I've known since the women's professional soccer era, which was the previous league, for those who don't know, when Riley coached the team in Philadelphia and made the finals but did not win them. They made, I think, two finals. I'm going to have to look that up real quick. You'd think I would know that, wouldn't you? Off the top of my head. But anyway, it's been almost a decade now, believe it or not. Yes, they made the championship in 2010 and 2011, which was both years of their existence, believe it or not. They lost both finals, in fact, by very close. But, well, they lost the first one was not a close margin. The second one, they lost on penalties. But Paul Riley is now the manager of the Courage. And he's been there for all the years that they've been in North Carolina and has really built up a team of players who are not necessarily the biggest stars, but are immensely hard workers, are for the most part very talented, are often underrated by the general populace and often underrated by the U.S. national team too, we might notice. They beat, you know, Portland has always been the foil for Riley. The 1 year he coached out there, he couldn't really cut it because he's not great at managing the Tobin Heaths and the Sinclairs of the world, Christine Sinclairs of the world, who are the really big stars with the big egos. He wants a bunch of, he likes to call them underdogs, sort of, he likes to say they're the junkyard dog mentality, but he wants to build a team in his image. And when he does that, he's very successful. He won the, when Western New York won the final 2 years ago, they beat Portland and Portland in the semifinal, which was a huge upset. But then they beat Washington in the final, which was not your star-studded equivalent of the Thorns or whatnot. This year, they finally really beat the star-studded team in the final. And I think it was a great accomplishment. And yet, you would know, one would have to know that this was, this Courage team had plenty of genuine stars, if not big egos. Sam Mewis and Crystal Dunn, who are stalwarts for the U.S. women's team. Lynn Williams, who has had her cups of coffee with the national team and has scored a lot of goals in the NWSL. Abby Ersig, who was the defender of the year in the NWSL, plays for New Zealand. Next to her, Abby Dahlkepper, who plays for the United States. And Jess McDonald, also up front, who has only had a cameo or two with the U.S., but is really good, led the league this year in assists and also scored 10 goals. You know, they played the Thorns in the final. They won the Shield last year. They went for the best regular season title. Then lost to the Thorns in the final. And Riley knew that in order to get over that hump and get all the way to the top, he had to go and get a little something special. So he convinced Crystal Dunn to come home from Chelsea. And they've known each other since Dunn played in Riley's old youth club out on Long Island. When Dunn was very young. And he also went out and got, during the middle of the season, Heather O'Reilly, the, you know, the U.S. national team player of many, many years, who retired from the national team, went over to play for Arsenal for a year and a half, decided to come back to the United States, makes her home in the Raleigh area because she went to the University of North Carolina. And it just seemed a perfect fit. And here were, you know, two of those players who just had that little bit, you know, something extra. O'Reilly might not be what she used to be, obviously, but in certain moments, you want that little bit of veteran savvy, you know? So they went out this year, and not only did they win the Shield, they did it with the best record in NWSL history. The most wins, the fewest losses, the most goals scored, the fewest conceded. And in July, they won the inaugural edition of the International Women's Champions Cup. Maybe a glorified friendly in some ways, but... And, you know, obviously they benefited from being close to Miami and being available. But they beat Lyon in the final, and they beat a fairly fully stacked Lyon in the final. And I was talking to Heather on Saturday, and they said that, yes, that did a little something for them, and it gave them a little extra push. And here they are, having gotten all the way to the top.
You know that... North Carolina Courage has a good team when Heather O'Reilly's on the bench, coming off the bench to be influential in the games. When we look at this result, 3-0 win for North Carolina Courage versus the Portland Thorns in the final, you mentioned Tobin Heath, you mentioned Christine St. Clair. Is this a place and time in the NWSL, in the league, maybe over the last 2 years, but especially with this result, where the game changer, the one superstar, is not enough anymore, and the team concept of O'Reilly might be might be what this league now strive for?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in that if you look at the Orlando Pride not making the playoffs this year, after making the playoffs this year, bringing back a mostly the same roster, and obviously having the big two guns at the top in Alex Morgan and Marta, and having Ashlyn Harris in net, and they didn't make the playoffs. And in fact, they were out of the playoff race before the last weekend of the season. And then Tom Cervani, you know, was out, as people have seen by now. And yet, when you look at the playoffs as a whole, I think you do still need a sum of top talent, whether it is Alex Morgan and Tobin Heath and Christine Sinclair, or in the case of Seattle, Megan Rapinoe and Jody Taylor, or in the case of Chicago, Sam Kerr, You know, look at what Sam Kerr did to haul the Red Stars to where they got. You do still need some of it, but what it speaks to, I think, perhaps more than the star model being dead, is the quality of the depth in the NWSL. And the quality of some of the players who are not quite good enough to make the U.S. national team, or maybe even from time to time other national teams. And that, I think, is going to be very interesting to follow as we now head into a World Cup year, a year where there is going to be a lot more attention paid to the NWSL, rightly so, and a time when, because of that attention, and there is going to be money that comes with that, there will be renewed talk, as there are those always talk, but there will be even more talk of expansion in the league. And you're going to have entities that want to come on board. Now, if I were them, I would come on board at the start of 2019 and get in before the tide starts to rise, as it were. From the sound of things, that's not going to happen. There won't be expansion until 2020. The league needs it, I think, and it actually needs it rather badly. And one of the reasons why it needs it, you know, we talk sometimes in MLS about how expansion dilutes the talent, especially the domestic talent, and it gets made up for, you know, by signing international players and so on. I think the talent in the NWSL right now is a little bit too condensed. You know, when there is an international window, it affects the league too much in some ways. And I think expansion will help solve that.
Well, you bring me to this point, Jonathan. I was talking off the record with a university in Canada here in a women's program in soccer, and they were telling me how amazing the talents were across the board in this country, and I believe it's the same in the United States, where there's a generation coming up. There's a generation there right now, but with lack of opportunity locally, they never can break the glass ceiling and become truly fledged professionals, and they're floundering in their decision of, should I keep playing? Should I move on to my regular job? And expansion would give 23 players per team an opportunity, and we're just coming off a year and a half, 2 year period where the big teams in Europe, talking about the Chelsea, like you mentioned, Lyon, PSG, were attracting a lot of the players, and now some of those players are coming back to play here in North America. What is the answer? You mentioned expansion. Is there a market in my Vancouver that you would feel like it's necessary, or is it truly now maybe time to accept and embrace what the Courage has been doing as well, using the infrastructure of the man's side to truly raise the level as well of their woman program?
Well, look, I think that you know, Vancouver is certainly on that list. And as the word has gotten around, you know, Harji Johal has done some of the reporting on this for Equalizer Soccer and Red Nation Online. And I happen to be in Vancouver. Gentlemen, I was on Vancouver of all places, in Vancouver of all places, on vacation the day that Alfonso Davies was in Philadelphia to sign with Bayern Munich. What a
That's
life.
Hilarious.
There you go.
But I, you know, they had a little press conference that day that I went to, and I took the opportunity to, you know, to talk with Rachel Lewis and Bobby Leonarduzzi a little bit about the NWSL decision, because the question had been asked whether some of the money raised from the transfer fee might go to that, and they said that was when they first really confirmed that they were not going to do it. It later came up that one of the reasons why is that they wanted some rules to allow the Canadians to, what was it, for the Canadians to count as domestic on their team, I think it was. They wanted to be able to have some more Canadians on their team, and they weren't quite going to be allowed that, and they weren't so happy. I don't entirely fault the Whitecaps for that, but, you know, maybe if it was more than one Canadian team, we'd have a little bit of a different conversation, because, you know, to do it just with one team might be a little odd in some ways. Nonetheless, Dwayne, you can tell Paul Byrne if they want to have a women's league, I suppose they go right ahead. But no, in all seriousness, it would be good for the CPL to have a women's league at some point.
They're in the planning, Jonathan. It is on. I don't know how close they are to it, but that 100% is something they understand.
And we all know, and I think they all know too, it's about money, 100%, right?
Yeah, they have to get on the ground, get their feet in the ground on the men's side. And, you know, the blunt reality is the men's side has more commercial possibilities in the beginning. And that they need that. And that's unfortunate, but that is the world that we live. So that is what's happening.
The top of the list for NWSL expansion by some distance is Los Angeles. It is no secret that LAFC wants in. You know, having Mia Hammond part of the ownership group does not hurt. And obviously they would be able to attract some big stars to go play for that team. Fairly promptly. San Jose will be on the table by virtue of LA coming in, I think. There were conversations at one point about Barcelona putting some money into a team there. That seems perhaps now to not be happening. We will see if somebody else comes along with the money. Atlanta is certainly talked about. There is, there's some construction, I think, going on in the flat next to mine, if you hear some background noise.
No problem. We actually can't hear
Atlanta's on the list. There is demand, I think, from the fan base in Atlanta. I haven't quite figured out what the Atlanta United ownership group thinks about it, but it wouldn't surprise me. They certainly have the resources, and I know they have some interest. Do they have enough to jump all the way in? I don't know, but that's a possibility. I wonder if Cincinnati is a possibility. FC Cincinnati has seen some of the commercial potential in part because Rose Lavelle is from there, and there is a thriving youth scene there. We'll give them a little more of a presence in the Northwest. Sorry, in the Midwest. Not Northwest, obviously. We give them a little more presence in the Midwest, I think. And would give FC Cincinnati a little bit of a boost as they step up the ranks. We don't quite know. You know, I don't think one assumes that they're going to win the MLS Cup in their first year. You know, they're going to have some money to spend, but not an immense amount. And perhaps having a women's team in a few years would give them a little more, you know, depth as an organization. And then the big question is what happens with Sky Blue, you know? And that's something that I've been digging into and a number of other people are digging into, because the New York market has got to matter for the NWSL. And nominally, Sky Blue is the New York market team. But they are talking about moving their operations further south in New Jersey, which would put them closer to Philadelphia, in fact, in New York. And that's got to, I think, if the door is not already open for a team within New York, and by that I mean, Dwayne, a team run by City Football Group.
Yeah.
Sky Blue moving further south would open the door even more. Now, on top of that, if the NWSL decides that Sky Blue's time is up because they're not willing to make the investments that are necessary to run a professional organization, and we have seen this year, the reports on how unprofessional that organization is. The question is if City Football Group is ready to move now, would the NWSL come down from over the top and tell Sky Blue their time is up?
They've certainly shown that they're willing to do that, are willing to make moves like that, is what I'm saying, Jonathan. I want to talk about, I guess, one dark aspect of the game. I hate to say dark, but every time that she touched the ball, Jalen Hinkle was booed, obviously to react to the remarks that she made earlier in the year, which were homophobic in nature. She has become a villain within the industry, within the overall women's soccer community for many, many people who for a long time viewed that as a safe place for them to be. I'm wondering whether her participation in the game at a high level still says anything about the changing nature of women's soccer. Is it becoming less of the sort of small sort of niche community that it once was, and is it going to evolve into something where you have to deal with issues like this more often, or is this an isolated sort of individual thing that's happening?
My inclination is that it's isolated. However, I don't think she's going to be the last of it. One might hope that One might hope that she is the last one, obviously. Her views are homophobic. That is a statement of about, I think, as close to fact as one would offer, you know. Her views are derogatory, and it is a point of fact that her views and her remarks hurt people, especially a lot of people in the women's soccer community. And no matter what anybody else tries to say, it is a point of fact that people are hurt. I've said this in confidence to some of my friends in the women's soccer media who are out publicly and out in some cases privately and have been hurt by Hinkle. And that is something that nobody else can take away from them or fix, because it's not the rest of our decision to judge whether or not somebody else is hurt. The one thing that I have said is that I cannot take Hinkle's religion away from her. I can find her views to be homophobic, which I do. I think that's close to a statement of fact at this point. I can find her views to be bigoted, which I do. I can find that in a locker room, she is a professional, and even her teammates, some of whom are out, get along with her very well, even if they find her views bigoted. And I think if you were to survey the Courage locker room, as some have done, that is what you would find. You would find teammates standing up for her who might surprise in standing up for her. But I cannot take her religion away from her, gentlemen, and also to the listeners out there. And the reason why I cannot take her religion away from her, even though I might through reason and a face-to-face conversation, whether by me or somebody else, try to change her views in some form, I cannot take her religion away from her, because if I say that, then anybody might say back to me that they might try to take my religion away from me. And fellas, it's no secret to you or anybody else that I, being Jewish, have experienced that, as have plenty of the rest of my faith, on a number of times over the last, 5,000 years or so.
Give or take.
I would hope that in time, Hinkle changes her mind through reason among fellow humans, not through any necessarily divine intervention or whatnot.
This is a conversation that is very relevant when you're looking at the state of politics.
Everything.
The state of everything in Ontario, in United States, and with the election coming in Quebec. Yeah, this is very relevant. And you're right. It's a slippery slope. When you start to say no to one, it's hard then to say yes or no to others.
Let's say this, by the way, Kevin. I'm glad you said what you just said about the election in Quebec. None of us is on a high horse.
No.
Whether it's you are a liberal in Montreal who looks at the rest of your province, whether you in Seattle, which is very liberal and looks at the rest of the state of Washington, Portland, which is very liberal and the rest of the state of Oregon is not at all. Much of the rest of the state of Oregon is quite conservative. As is no secret to a lot of people in this part of the country, that Philadelphia is very liberal, the rest of Pennsylvania is not. New York City is very liberal, much of the rest of the state of New York is not. You know, none of us ought to be on a high horse. But instead, perhaps, we might better devote our energies to doing the work to make things better.
Yeah, let's tolerate each other. That should be the key word of this conversation, tolerance. Moving to a little different spectrum, quite a busy week for the Philadelphia Union with two impressive results. Traveling to Seattle win midweek, and with Jay Simpson, of all people, being effective late in the game, Philly down to 10 men, scoring the late winner, winning 1-0 versus the Sounders in Seattle, and then moving to Sunday, yesterday at home versus Sporting Kansas City, and a 2-0 win for the Philadelphia Union. Was this the most important week of their 2018 season, especially regarding their potential playoff spot?
It was certainly the most stunning. Not only, by the way, did they beat Sporting Kansas City yesterday, they did so with only two of their 11 regular starters starting. You know, Jim Curtin rotated his squad heavily in order to rest everyone for the U.S. Open Cup final on Wednesday. And lo and behold, they beat Sporting, the best team in the West, 2-0. It's very, very impressive. And it is good for Jay Simpson, who has been a loyal soldier and one who makes a lot of money, was signed last year to be the number one striker, was beaten on the depth chart by C.J. Sapong, who finally had some competition and it forced him to raise his game, and then this year was beaten by Corey Burke, but kept putting the work in. He's a very nice guy, and that doesn't count for anything, obviously, you know, most of the, on Saturday, it doesn't count for anything, you're a nice guy. But he is a very nice guy. You can tell he puts the work in. It is a deserved reward for him to have a little bit of time in the spotlight.
And when we look now, Philly, I believe 6 points clear of the Montreal Impact in fifth position. The Montreal Impact 5 points clear of DC United. Will those two wins, do they solidify their place, to not say almost guarantee a playoff berth? Because if those two games would have gone a different way, with DC and Montreal breathing down their neck, this could have been a very different end of season in the Eastern Conference playoff race.
You know, when the Union lost to Montreal, a lot of people were a little worried. Thought they might be about to collapse with everything that was about to come. These two games against Kansas City and Seattle, the Open Cup, then at Columbus this coming Saturday. I think they're almost clear now in fifth. Almost. Certainly if they beat Columbus, they will be. And then all of a sudden, fourth is on the table. And on the last day of the season, the Union play at New York City FC. Heaven knows where exactly, but still. New York City FC's got 50 points. And they're struggling a little bit at the moment, I think it's safe to say, fellas.
Six games without a win for NYCFC.
If they don't get things on track, is third place in play on the last week of the season? That wasn't my idea first. It was my friend Joe Tanzi, who writes for Pro Soccer USA. But nonetheless, I wonder.
Well, NYCFC's in trouble. The Union are, to me, the third best team in the East right now.
I wonder if, well, you know, and it's funny because coming into the weekend, I could have said Columbus was in a little trouble too.
Yeah, but the team that they beat wasn't.
Well, they have a very easy schedule the rest of the way out. So I don't think they're going anywhere. Except, well.
Excuse the pun.
Sorry. That was an interesting turn of phrase by people.
Yes. Excuse. So the dream of the MLS Cup final being in Columbus that circus dream is still alive.
I'd say so. Yes. Yeah. I'd say so.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to Columbus at that place. Anyway, all right, Jonathan, we've kept you a long time today. We might as well say goodbye. Anything you want to promote before we say goodbye?
A couple things. I spent the weekend in Portland writing for Pro Soccer USA. On the NWSL final. That is obviously a website that is of no secret to anybody at this point. If you are a women's... sorry, I had another call coming in for some reason. If you are a women's soccer fan, they are working very hard to increase their NWSL coverage. It is something that they want to do. Please reward them with your attention and clicks and so on. They are run out of the Orlando Sentinel, and they are very good people. Who I've got the pleasure to got to know over the last couple of years. You guys have had, I think, Alicia Delgado on this show a few times. She's the editor. And I have a story coming up there later this morning about Jessica McDonald, who was the MVP of the NWSL and is one of the rare, very well-known players in the NWSL who's also a mother and has been traded many, many times in her career and has moved with her son and her husband. And that's not easy on anybody, whether you're single or, in this case, whether you're moving your kid around all over the place. So give that a read. Also, while we were on the line here, gentlemen, it looks like France Football announced that there will be a Ballon d'Or for the women's players beginning this year, which is a nice thing to see.
That you'd almost want to say, why did it take them so long? But that's congratulations for the right move nonetheless.
Jonathan Tannenwald of the Philadelphia Inquirer, thank you very much for your time today, Jonathan, and we'll be right back after this break.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at Soccer Today SPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/ Sports Podcasting Network. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
And we're back on Soccer Today. If you want to follow Jonathan Tannenwald, you can do so on Twitter and social media at The Goalkeeper. Now it's time for the Canadian/MLS review. Dwayne, we can put the final nail in TFC's coffin. If Montreal would have won on Saturday, combined with TFC's loss against the Red Bulls, well, it would have been official. Now, it's not official, but it's just a question of time. TFC will not make the playoffs in 2018.
Well, the tragic number is 5. So TFC can get up to 45 points. Montreal's on 40, so average, they get 5 points. They will eliminate that. So basically, the chance, and it is just Montreal now. I think that your evaluation of the playoff race is it's between Montreal and DC United. DC United still has 2 games in hand, so you won't want to count them out, but they're going to be battling it out for that 6th place. I think that the teams above, as Jonathan said, Columbus with the easier schedule, Philadelphia trending the right way, I think that that's probably going to be the battle that you're looking at there for. It's done. The TFC's done. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Like, there's no mystery here. I think that what I tweeted out following the game was, look, I can't be angry at this season. It's gone completely off the rails because, just pulling it up here, they have the 4th worst defensive record in the league. They've gone from TFC last year had, I believe they were 2nd or 3rd in their defensive stats. Overall, in the entire league, they have completely 180'd that and gone back to form. And I mean, it's the injuries are outrageous this season. They truly are unique in terms of a club. It's one thing to have injuries, and you can take your amount of games that players have been out. Like, overall, that doesn't tell a full story when you look at the impact of the big names that have been out for TFC, in particular at that back. When you lose both of your starting center halves, you just can't expect to compete, and it shows just how, you know, TFC was famously deep last year. They were. But where they weren't as deep was on the back, and they've been decimated with injuries at the back this year. And they moved guys like Betashore out, which I think was a mistake. I think they should have found a way to keep Betashore into the mix because I believe that he provided a stability and a leadership back there that was missing. I think that you're seeing Justin Morrow's offensive production decline because he has to hang back more, doesn't have that anchor at the back holding him there that he did last year. Obviously, Mavinga's been massive. His loss for the TFC this year has been absolutely massive. He could have been among the top defenders in the year, and we don't know what Drew Moore is anymore. That injury, I don't know. So that's what they're going to have to fix quickly. They're done now. They should be looking at everything that they have. I mean, mathematically speaking, some crazy finish happens when both DC and Montreal somehow stop winning altogether.
And lose game, yeah. Well, that's not going to happen. The thing is, too, you were mentioning Montreal and DC are the 2 teams realistically vying.
I should probably not have say eliminated New England. I just forget about them all the time, too.
Well,
continue.
New England is similar to DC right now. 5 points back of Montreal. They have 1 game in hand versus the Impact, but it's New England. So we never truly know what to expect. And the beautiful thing about this year's schedule is, well, Montreal is playing DC United next week. And then they're playing Columbus at home. And the last game of the season on the 28th is in Foxborough against New England. So they will cannibalize each other for points. None of those teams are going to win out. There's going to be an outlier or a win here and there. And talking to Daniel Lovitz after the game in Montreal Saturday, we were asking him, Daniel, with this 1-1 draw against NYCFC, does this put more pressure onto the game in Washington at Audi Field next week against DC? He's like, well, we were under no impression at all to begin with this game against DC. It's a must-win game. It has crazy awesome implications for the playoff. We just want to compete. So regardless of the draw or a win on Saturday, this game would always been that important. And you're mentioning 5 points. If Montreal goes on the road and win like they did in Philly, they can do it. They have done it 3 times this year, one recently. If they go to DC United, they increase that gap to 8 points then. Even though DC will still have 5 games in hand, 8 points. Points on the board or points in the pocket. And 8 points is a lot of points. And even though DC has an easy schedule, a home mostly, still, they have to go almost on a run to bridge the gap that they created themselves in the beginning of the season. And it would be the same for TFC, but it's 10 points back at this point for TFC, and it's almost an insurmountable mountain.
Well, yeah. TFC's done. Like, they're done. They should be playing kids the rest of the way. Absolutely shutting people down, like I said last week. I said he'd in this game. It'd be almost a blessing in disguise, because had they won, they would have caught a couple points up on Montreal, because Montreal drew. Had they got a win, then suddenly you're looking at, 33-38, and it would be, okay, maybe. And then you still have to grind it out. But I think at this point, yeah, it's almost a blessing in disguise, as I said. In terms of the Montreal and any of those teams, what any one of those teams that are battling for that final spot really, really need and want and depend upon is for one of them to break away so that they can set themselves up on that last week, because that is the true challenge to when you're battling 5-6. It's a real handicap, because you have to turn around in less than a week, fly somewhere and play a game, and that is just never going to be easy in this league. Once you get through that, you know, it's new season. But to me, that's the disadvantage that you do have when you're on the road team in that knock-in game. And if you can't set you, if you're playing on the last weekend needing a win, needing points, the chances of you getting those points in the final weekend and then turning around 4 days later and winning to advance, it's just a greater challenge. So ideally, if you're the Impact, you just want to keep putting pressure there so that you go into that final week and say, okay, we're six. We know that. We're just going to rest our players and see what happens and see who we draw. I don't know who you'd want, though. I think you don't want in with.
Well, do you? Because the thing is, doesn't mean the game's going to happen at Yankee Stadium. Because the Yankees are in the playoffs, in the postseason in Major League Baseball, which that means they have first dibs on the stadium. And that could mean what we've seen in the last few years, where as much as a home field advantage NYCFC has at home at Yankee Stadium, if this game is played somewhere else on a bigger pitch, guess what? That advantage goes away.
Yeah, absolutely. That is their advantage for sure. I don't know what to make of NYCFC. We should get an NYCFC guest on, because something has not gone right. And like, Vieira's leaving didn't have that much disruption. That's the only thing I can come up with. That's the one commonality to that, right?
That's the easy narrative. But I would say that now the pressure of not winning games in 6-6 has actually changed the way they play. And let's take the game against Montreal. Montreal was able to muzzle NYCFC to only 6 shot. In the 2 games before, they had 53. 53 shots in a draw and a loss for NYCFC, because they want those goals. They really want to maybe force those goals. And Montreal did a smart thing by putting a lot of pressing. It was a battle of the midfield on Saturday in San Saputo. It was Michael Azira, Samuel Piet, and Safir Taider putting a high press on the midfield. And I have to say, on the other side, Ring played an amazing game. Matarita, the fullback, played an amazing game as well to counteract Daniel Lovitz and Bakary Sagna, which had the most amount of touches for Montreal. So it truly was a battle of the midfield and the flanks. And you see this in the amount of chances created, not a lot on both sides. And you see this in the amount of saves, 4 saves for Bush, 3 saves for Johnson. It wasn't the most compelling second half, to be quite honest. But Montreal were able to at least get the equalizer once again. And that's what we asked the impact. I asked Michael Azira, who scored his first goal in Major League Soccer after a few years, and his first goal since last year in the U.S. Open Cup for Colorado. Michael, how important was the press, first of all, and what does it say about Montreal's mentality that now it's two games in a row coming back from one goal down to get a result? Where he's like, our mentality is evolving. Our mentality physically and our mentality, our confidence is growing at the right time. And we're not afraid anymore. When we go one goal down, we know we can get it back with the Silva, with the Titer, with Nacho Piatti. So you do have those offensive tools for Montreal that, if used correctly, the thing is, I've talked about how Montreal was able to nullify the passing and shooting on target for NYCFC by putting a high press. NYCFC was able to nullify Montreal's hold-up play with Quincy Amarikwa or Mancosu, which was non-existent. 40% passing accuracy. Jeez, that was terrible in 20 minutes, Matteo Mancosu. But for Quincy Amarikwa, he was stifled. His service was stifled. He had 16 touches in 74 minutes. He did not see the ball, was not able to play his game of holding up the ball for a few seconds, letting Silva and Piatti get open. It was truly a tactical midfield type of game where to truly understand what happened there, just watching the game is not enough. You truly have to look at the small details of this game, and it was a fair result, the 1-1, NYCFC in Montreal.
Yeah, well, it should give them confidence, as you say. And, you know, I'm going to reiterate something I put on Twitter in the weekend. If the Montreal Impact host a playoff game, I, Toronto boy, will come and stand with the Impact fans that day. So hopefully we get to see at least one Canadian playoff game in this country this year. We should talk about the Whitecaps as well.
Yeah, speaking of not hosting a playoff game and not going into the playoffs, we talked about TFC. Yeah, Vancouver's done too. They had an opportunity with Seattle losing, and they would have won in Portland. And no, Vancouver lost to Dallas at home. Did you know that the biggest signing as a teenager in the history of Major League Soccer could play left back? I didn't either. And I was like, oh, Robbo.
Yeah, he does like to put him back there sometimes. I guess that might help him down the line develop a little more defensive responsibility. But Alphonso Davies is not a left back. Alphonso Davies is a winger. And
Breck
a very good one.
Not
so
a,
I don't know.
And Breck Shea's not a right back. What's happening here?
Yeah, you know, Robbo has some unique. He only knows how to play one way. That's the issue. And when you watch the Whitecaps, I remember watching the Whitecaps season and their style and everything was epitomized by how they played the game of the Voyageurs Cup final. They're behind and they're sitting back, still absorbing pressure, even though they need to chase a game on the road. Like it made no sense how they played that game, but it's the only way they know how to play. They need some more tactical flexibility. I think they need a change. And I think Carl Robinson is a delightful fellow. But if I were a Whitecaps fan, I would be hashtag
Robbo. Full disclosure, Carl Robinson is awesome to have in a press conference. He gives you like he sees it. He tells you like it is. It's always interesting to interview him post-game, pre-game, mid-game. He's always open, always available, and not always in a good mood, which makes it even better because he's just himself. So that being said, Scotland is calling. Some team in Scotland wants him. Answer the call.
Yeah. Maybe we'll switch it out to, because we've been long already, because Jonathan, who had a lot of great material today to talk about in the NWSL final, Kevin, this isn't on our agenda, but I thought we'd throw it out this way to end it. I'm wondering, we talked a little bit about the possibility of NWSL in Canada. We've talked about this subject before. We've talked about the Canadian Premier League possibly starting a women's side before as well, but I think it's worthwhile coming off the heels of the championship game in that NWSL league to have that conversation again now. And I'm wondering, Kevin, what your preference would be. Do you think that they should be focusing on getting one or two NWSL teams here, or do you think that the focus is better served in starting a lower level but across the board women's league on the CPL side?
Which one is going to happen the quickest? And whatever that answer is, that's what you need to do. It's been long enough. And if there's a round of expansion in the NWSL, could happen quicker than a viable women league in this country. If you build it, they will come is not always true. Sometimes you have to get a franchise and get a brand name for people to come in. If you buy, let's say a popular Canadian franchise. If you buy a Tim Hortons, guess what? The first day of opening, you get a lineup and you get people coming to get you. If I open Kevin's Cafe, it's going to cost me a lot of money of advertising and marketing and of media talking about my new cafe for people to come and enjoy in the same way that they would if the branding was different. And WSL has a positive reputation. And bringing that branding for at least one team, maybe just for a temporary period, that would be fine with me. You get you grandfather a team into the other league after, whenever that league is ready and the same level, that's fine. But whatever the answer is, by the quickest way to have a professional women's soccer team in Canada is my answer. If Vancouver doesn't get their ducks in a row, and there's a very high probability that the Vancouver organization, the Whitecaps organization, are not even going to try. And that's fine. There's other owners out there. There's other organizations. The Impact, I've always said, no, it's not for us. And TFC, same. In principle, TFC is okay with it. But we still haven't seen the investment either on the MLSC's hockey side or the soccer side for a women's program.
Or the basketball side
for a program. The baseball side, even though it's non-existent. But you do have those possibilities there. Whatever organization, whatever the name of the owner could be, whatever city, just get a professional soccer team in Canada already, will you?
Yeah, I mean, I am almost positive that MLSE has looked into it because they look into everything. Obviously, what is happening is that they don't believe their ROI is going to be strong enough for them to justify it to, you know, a for-profit board, right? That's where it would come down to. They, you know, they are a company that has, you know, they're owned by two giant telecoms that are publicly traded. They need to do things with profit in mind. That's just the reality of what they're mandated to do. So if they can't justify an expense in there, it is difficult for them. But what I will say is, look, I'm ambivalent in terms of which direction to go because I see a value in both. I think that a lower level Canadian women's league with six or seven teams across has a lot of obvious, like lots of players playing. You throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall, some of the noodles stick sort of thing, right? So I think you would find more players developed there and you would find a better pathway developing from that. So ideally, that would be great. But I also think that the Canadian Premier League on the men's side is going to face so many challenges in the first few years in terms of drawing and marketing and all that. As much as I am a huge advocate for equality in sport, I do fully understand the business argument to focus on the men's side for 3, 4, 5 years even. And what I would suggest is maybe a middle ground here is that there are some NWSL franchises pursued for those business groups that are interested in being a part of that, and that there should be some kind of push to do that. And perhaps even, I'll make a crazy argument off the top, perhaps even collectively the Canadian Premier League could pursue an NWSL team in some manner to try and get a foothold in this country. And then with the idea that they move this forward in 5 years, say, to create their own division, and that team comes off at that point. That's maybe the option that gets this done. Even if it's an individual owner, like we see the North Carolina Courage, they're not owned by an MLS team. They're owned by a USL team, right? So there's no reason why a Canadian Premier League ownership group couldn't separately also pursue a women's team to bring it up here if they really feel that their market could bear that. There's lots of options, but you're right. The bottom line, and I'll let you jump in to finish the show after this, is that just someone has to have the gumption to say, let's try this, because without risk, there is no reward. And if we only looked at risk, TFC doesn't get launched in 2006 because they look at the failure of the past and go, well, this can't possibly work now. No, someone's got to have bravery to do this.
The gumption, or the fortitude of, you know where. You know, when you play Mario Kart, that type of fortitude, if you're in the United States. But it's funny, too, because I was on the press box Saturday. I was talking to colleague Doug McIntyre of Yahoo Sports, and we were talking about MLS, and we're talking about other things. And he says, Look, TFC changed everything in this league when they came into 2008 with the reception of the fans, even when they were floundering for years. And I think the same thing could be said for the women's game. You mentioned Vancouver. You mentioned North Carolina Courage and the North Carolina FC, Steve Malik's organization. It's not an organization. It's him deciding to put the money where his mouth is and to go with it. And we'll see where that leads the entire organization of those two entities. An example, another example that could happen. You have a few owners in Quebec City that have a lot of money. And the Canadian Premier League might be possible, and the potential of this for the next few years in Quebec City might be potential. But there's a great program at University Laval, the Rouge et Or, on the women's side, coached by Elder Duarte, and a lot of those players have nowhere to play after university. The stretch is not necessarily hard to make, saying, look, why don't we create a professional team, a WSL team, and you use the finishing graduates that are super good Canadian champions for how many, I don't know how many times over the last 10 years, just give them an opportunity. And I think it comes down to, is there someone with money that sees the value for its own benefit in the long run to make the expense? It's not about the game. It's not about creating more opportunity. Those are all great, great philanthropic ideas. But until someone has the belief that for their own pocket, it's good enough to invest, we're not going to see it.
Yeah. I'm sick of waiting for the women's side. I mentioned the basketball, the MLSE side. This is where I get a little frustrated with them. It's like the WNBA, there's really no argument that Toronto shouldn't be in the WNBA right now. I don't think at all. With the emergence of Canadian women's basketball, which is ranked fifth in the world,
yeah.
The fact that MLSE has the resources to cover some losses in the early stages, the fact that the WNBA is actually getting to an average attendance now that's sustainable anyway, all in all, that adds up to a no-brainer to me. But on both games that they're actively involved in, or all three games that they're actively involved in that have women's options, they have not chosen to pursue them in any of them. And I do think that they deserve. I know the capitalists, the pure capitalists out there will disagree with me, but I am not a pure capitalist. I believe that there is a bit of a social obligation for them to be in the women's side of the games in some fashion. And I'll leave it at that. Hopefully MLSE, I don't think they're listening to us directly, but hopefully, well, they do. Some of them do. I don't think they're taking orders from us, though. But hopefully someone in that organization is pushing this.
Yep, hopefully. And that's the idea. As always, you can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute. Myself at Kev Larmé. We'll be back tomorrow with a more overview look of the results this weekend in Major League Soccer and other great stories from the world of football with a soccer perspective. And until tomorrow, as always, have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.